This is The Takeaway for Thursday, March 2nd, 2017.
Well, I have not met with any Russians at any time to discuss any political campaign, and those remarks are unbelievable to me and are false, and I don't have anything else to say about that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This hour, the prosecutor's predicament. Attorney General Jeff Sessions finds himself in the Russian swamp, and a cold place it is. More on that in just a moment. Mostly this hour, we are noting how Donald Trump's upsetting the apple cart with his non-Washington, D.C. style, his brash talk about the enemy media, and his blunt policy flip-flopping has managed to reignite some important policy debates on Capitol Hill. We will look at two of those this hour, immigration and health care. And also on our own, we will examine through two very individual stories what the government owes in the way of help to inmates leaving prison and veterans spending the rest of their lives dealing with severe permanent injuries. But first, if the Russian Navy had fired a cruise missile at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, they couldn't have done more damage to him than reports that then-Senator Sessions met with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. twice last year. And that's the same man Michael Flynn met with and got fired over. Sessions did not disclose this little item in his confirmation hearing to become attorney general. There is an uproar now in Washington, D.C. Republicans are coming to his defense.
Should he recuse himself? I think he answered that question this morning, which is if he himself is the subject of an investigation, of course he would. But if he's not, I don't see any purpose or reason to doing this.
Paul Ryan spoke. And of course, Democrats are calling for resignations and recusals and using other kinds of words. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Is Sessions still in session? What's the latest?
It's going to be a question, John, of whether Jeff Sessions can continue to lead the Justice Department in a capacity where there appears to be an FBI investigation that may be of a criminal nature into contacts between the Donald Trump campaign and Russians. Now, I say maybe because senators themselves are starting to get frustrated with what the FBI knows and what they have and haven't been told. We'll get to that. Let's get to some reaction on Capitol Hill as the Sessions news came out overnight. Jim Lankford is a senator from Oklahoma, John. He's on the Intelligence Committee. And I want to play this tape because this reflects what a lot, although not all Republicans are saying in the early hours here after the Jeff Sessions revelations, that in fact he did talk to Russians when he told the Judiciary Committee that he did not.
The implication is somehow he's colluding behind the scenes. We don't know that. We don't have any facts. There was no bump exchange of secret documents here. I mean, we don't have anything like that. We have a meeting and a conversation. What I'm stunned by is the rapid move to assume the worst on something we know almost nothing about at this point.
Well, we know something. We know that he was asked about this at his confirmation hearing, and he asked as though, Russia? Where's Russia? I mean, he didn't even acknowledge that there was any possible contact.
Was asked directly about it, and it seems like the problem that senators have is not that a senator met with a Russian ambassador. That's not inappropriate. That kind of thing is very common, except that he was asked directly whether he had any contacts, and he said that he did not. So here's Claire McCaskill. She's on the Armed Services Committee along with Jeff Sessions, which is why he talked to the Russians in the first place, or so he said. Here's McCaskill.
I believe he should resign. Well, he's a prosecutor. Now, the question was very specific, and he not only misled the committee with his answer, he went out of his way to add comments that made it even more misleading.
Now, the way this works is Sessions said that he was a surrogate for the Trump campaign, and he also said that he met with Russian ambassador figures, but not as a surrogate. So as a senator, it's perfectly fine, but if you did it as a surrogate, that's a problem, but we don't know which is which.
Well, that's right, and there have been some shifting explanations even since last night from Sessions spokespersons about what the nature of those discussions were. At one point, a spokesperson said the campaign was never discussed when then-Senator Sessions met with the Russian ambassador. Then that explanation shifted to say, well, there was campaign banter, but it wasn't substantive. And then Jeff Sessions' own statement to say he never met with the Russians to discuss the campaign, meaning that wasn't the point of the meeting. And Jeff Sessions is a prosecutor and is a lawyer. And I'm here to tell you that in situations like that, he chooses his words very carefully. Now,
FBI investigation isn't about whether people discussed the campaign. The FBI investigation is about whether they discussed sanctions and questions of policy that would make it a felony.
Maybe, John, but there may be other parts of an FBI investigation that we're not aware of and that senators aren't aware of, and they're starting to get frustrated about that. Why? Because we all know that old trope, right? We don't discuss details of ongoing investigations. Well, senators have been hearing that, too, from James Comey, the FBI director. Now one of their own is getting sucked into this, at least a guy who used to be their own. Here's Lindsey Graham, who last night on CNN said that if it is true that Jeff Sessions did meet with the Russians, he'll at least have to recuse himself from any ongoing investigations. But Graham is frustrated now with what he's been reading in the papers. Listen.
There's no speed limit here. You know, I want to get it right. And I am tired of reading about innuendo. Somebody is leaking this crap and is putting people like me in a terrible spot. So I'm going to meet with the FBI director today, and I'm going to look him in the eye, and he's going to tell me there's an investigation, or there's not. And if he doesn't tell me, he's going to have a hard time.
Well, but it is either they talked or they didn't talk. And what is a Sessions recusal going to actually mean to the operation of the government over the next year?
And those questions are seeing around corners. Would it mean a special prosecutor appointed within the Department of Justice? The independent counsel statute is dead. We don't have those anymore. If you want to go back to the days of Ken Starr, the independent counsel statute is gone. Chuck Schumer says we can maybe have a new law that would allow for one. So if Sessions recuses, could they appoint somebody new, like they did in the Scooter Libby case, to oversee that kind of investigation? But it's not just about discussing Russian sanctions. It may go beyond that. And that's part of Lindsey Graham's frustration, is that senators don't seem to know the scope of the FBI's own investigation here because they haven't been told. Lindsey Graham now says he's going to look Comey in the eye and he wants to know the answer to that. I don't know that James Comey is in any more of a mood than he was 2 weeks ago to discuss the details of an ongoing investigation. That got him into a little bit of trouble in the closing days of the campaign when it came to emails, didn't it? So we're getting into some very dicey territory now between senators, certainly, and the FBI. One thing that Lindsey Graham did say that was definitive is that now that it is clear that Jeff Sessions met with the Russians twice when he said he didn't, senators need to know what was discussed, John, and what the nature of those discussions were.
Very quickly, Todd, Trump is loyal to Sessions. He seems to like Sessions. How long does that last, do you think?
He does seem to like him, and Jeff Sessions seems to have a lot of political mind meld with Donald Trump. I don't know where this goes, John. This might be dependent upon senators. Maybe the more important question to ask is, what does it take for people who've known Jeff Sessions for 20 years to really turn on him?
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Well, the Russian chaos roils Washington, D.C. The real policy debates are actually beginning. The Repeal Obamacare campaign promise, which started out as an angry partisan vendetta, has turned into a very familiar discussion of what the government's role in healthcare should be. But because this is a Republican discussion, you won't hear words like single payer or comparisons to Canada's healthcare system. We do have a reason to emulate Canada, but on another issue later this hour. To remind us of specific healthcare proposals beloved of the so far divided GOP, we turn to Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Welcome back, Mary Agnes.
Thanks for having me.
So suddenly we're talking about a GOP, I guess, mix of plans to replace Obamacare. It's basically the Republican version of what is government's responsibility for health care. What does it look like?
Well, it's a variety of things. They're talking about some tax incentives to try to get people to put money away to help pay for their health insurance. This idea of high-risk pools may be coming back, the idea of some of the sickest folks being taken out of the risk pool and put into a separate pool to have their insurance paid that way. There's some talk about changing Medicaid from an entitlement where it's currently matched on state spending on a variety of formulas to something called a block grant, a set amount of money. So there's a lot of Republican ideas that have been in the Republican playbook for a long time. They're trying to go back to them and see how they could work.
Are savings accounts one of the plans that would address comprehensively a replacement of Obamacare?
I don't know if it would be comprehensively. It certainly could be an option for some people. It allows individuals to have an account, which they would keep with them, wouldn't be tied to an employer, for example, and they could put money away on a tax-free basis that would accrue tax-free, rollover from year to year, and as long as you use that money for approved health care expenses, you wouldn't be taxed on it. But the issue there is having that money to put into a health savings account. For example, currently under current law, an individual could put up to $3,400 a year. Families could put up to $6,750 per year. Republicans are talking about lifting those ceilings, lifting the higher amounts, or removing the ceiling entirely. But the issue is, who's got money to do that? It tends to be people that have more disposable income. So the question, central question here is, are health savings accounts really going to work for everyone?
Are health savings accounts a way for the GOP to say this isn't a mandate? We've got voluntary options that people don't have to do anything. And a savings account is basically the most voluntary way for people to get themselves covered.
Republicans are certainly not going to require anybody to buy health insurance. But one of the points behind health savings accounts from Republicans and many proponents is it has the individual have some skin in the game. Right. If you are spending your own money and perhaps you have to spend all of your money till you hit that deductible, you might think twice before you go to the emergency room or get another medical procedure. Now, some health savings accounts cover preventive services. They don't require you to hit that deductible before you get it, but for other services, you would. So I think the real Republican tenet here is that you will be responsible, more responsible with your dollars if you have a health savings account and have to shell out money out of your pocket, hit these deductibles before your insurance coverage kicks in.
Can Republicans, through an incentive plan, inflate the pool big enough so that it's financially viable both for the government and for the insurance industry?
I think what they will do is provide periods of enrollment. For example, they're saying if you're continuously covered, you couldn't face a higher premium based on your pre-existing medical condition. Republicans are not going to require anyone to have health insurance, but they want to do other sort of incentives to get you to enroll, but not mandate that you enroll. So if you say to consumers, for example, this is one of the Republican theories, here is the open enrollment period right now. Doesn't matter your medical history, you can be enrolled. Or you have health insurance, if you keep that going, if you're continuously covered, then you will never be discriminated against based on your medical condition, which could get more people into the pool. But we know with the Affordable Care Act, all the difficulties they've had in attracting young people and trying to get enough healthy people to balance the sick people. So without a mandate, the hurdle might be even higher to get that risk pool balanced.
Can they control costs through any of these plans, keep premiums down, that sort of thing?
Well, that is a great question. The thought is, for example, if you lift prohibition about selling health insurance across state lines, right, that you'll have all these insurers flood the market. That's currently allowed in three states. Insurers aren't doing it, so that is questionable. And how much will you give people to help them pay for health insurance? And if people are covered and get medical care, will that help reduce costs? Health care insurance, health care premiums, health care costs are cyclical. They go up, they go down. We've gone through sort of a historically low growth period, but no one's really found the magic formula to keep health care costs down on a continuous basis. It does tend to go in cycles.
Well, the Republicans are looking for that magic, that's for sure. Mary Agnes Carey, partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Mary Agnes.
Thank you.
And so just as the Trump turmoil has restarted a discussion of the government's role in health care, the same can be said about immigration reform. After weeks of anticipation, President Trump said in his address to Congress this week that he now wants a merit-based system for admitting new immigrants to the country. Huh? What's that? Stephen Yale Lair is a professor of immigration law practice at Cornell Law School, and he says that can mean a lot of different things. But to get there, Congress still has to make some fundamental decisions.
We have to make a philosophical decision about the role of immigration in our society and how to select the proper immigrants to help us advance as a society.
So what are the modalities that are on the table, both the kind of things that the GOP is likely to come close to even talking about and the things that the Trump administration has suddenly put on the table?
Well, to back up, you have to understand our current immigration system. We select about 1 million people a year to get green cards in the United States. About 75% of those are selected based on family characteristics. They're married to U.S. citizens, or their sons and daughters of U.S. citizens, et cetera. 140,000 are based on employment characteristics. Another 85 to 100,000 come in each year based on humanitarian principles. They apply for asylum or they're refugees. And we select 50,000 a year based on a diversity lottery, just a lottery to let people come in here. People say that's not the best way to select immigrants into the United States, that if we want to compete globally, we really need to try to select the best and the brightest, whatever that means. Congress has been facing this issue for years. It came close in 2013 with a comprehensive immigration reform bill that passed the Senate but failed to get through the House. And as part of that process, they began to think about how to restructure the way we select immigrants.
And the ones that you've talked about, the modalities that you've talked about, are they the tip of the iceberg of this entire sort of undocumented problem that looms before us?
We have a broken immigration system. Because the backlogs in getting into the United States legally are so long, people have entered the United States illegally, or they've come legally temporarily, but then overstayed their visas. And so how to deal with the undocumented part of our population is part and parcel of comprehensive immigration reform. If we were able to structure our legal immigration system properly so that employers who need people temporarily can get them, but we can also assure that people who work here temporarily go home, then we wouldn't have as big of an illegal population. And so Congress needs to figure out all of this. It's sort of like three legs of a stool. You have to figure out what to do about the undocumented. You need to figure out your legal immigration system going forward. And you need to have border enforcement to make sure that people abide by the laws and they come in legally and they leave when it's time for them to return home.
All right. So let me just reset the table here, the three-legged table. If the security issue can be resolved, what really needs to happen is the backlog needs to be eliminated so that people can come in without having these huge long lines that encourage people to break the law. If you can do that, you've fixed your system, except for the security question, and we'll get to that in a minute. Is that about right?
Absolutely. It's sounds simplistic, but it's tough to do in reality because you can't have a static immigration system. Circumstances change, the economy changes, and so we have had an immigration system that has not been changed on the legal side since 1990, 27 years ago. The world has changed dramatically since then, but our immigration system is sadly out of date. And we need to get it back into sync, but we also need to create a system more like Canada's that allows flexibility going forward.
Joining us now is Melissa Babel, who is a certified immigration law specialist with the Law Society of Upper Canada, senior manager at KPMG Law in Toronto, Canada. Melissa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So I can't imagine you listened to Donald Trump's speech the other night, but he did say this one thing that relates to Canada, relates to where you live.
Nations around the world, like Canada, Australia, and many others, have a merit-based immigration system.
Now, that's familiar to you, right, Melissa?
It is. A merit-based system is actually how we have selected immigrants in Canada for many, many years. We have looked at the person's ability to become economically established in Canada as the basic test for economic immigration to Canada.
And the idea is that if you meet some sort of merit, if you meet a set of criteria, you are rewarded by being allowed to come into Canada. I'm assuming if you want to live in Canada, right?
Exactly. We hand out parkas as they arrive.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, the basic system is that, you know, the person's ability to be economically established is assessed based on their language abilities, their work experience both inside Canada and outside of Canada, their education, and some sort of open factors about their adaptability to Canada. That's the basic system. We have subsequently added a program specifically for people who have worked in Canada called the Canadian Experience Class, and that allows any applicant who's got 1 year of skilled work experience in Canada to apply for immigration.
All right, let's bring Stephen Yalair back into the discussion. He's professor of immigration law at Cornell Law School. When you described a moment ago those criteria for allowing people into the United States. That's a merit-based system, right?
It's not really merit-based. We have an employer-sponsored system to select economic immigrants to the United States. So an employer says, I need a computer programmer. It doesn't go to a broader picture of how well is that person going to fit into society. Do they know English well? Do they have a family support structure? So it's not really a merit-based system the same way that Canada is.
All right, Melissa Babel, we're going to find out if Stephen Yale-Lair is actually envious of the system that you have in Canada. Stephen, talk to me.
I am envious. I wrote a book 20 years ago proposing a point system that was based on Canada and Australia's at the time, because I think that it injects more flexibility into a system. Since then, I have modified my views. Now I think you need sort of a hybrid model. So I think a combination between what employers want short term and what society needs long term is probably the best way to go. It's not easy to do, but I think Canada is trying as well as any other country to create that hybrid model.
Melissa, do you think that this Canadian model can be scaled up for what the U.S. would need?
Oh, certainly. My colleague here has stated it well. I mean, the first issue is the entry of temporary foreign workers into Canada, principally with employer support. And then the second issue is keeping those foreign workers and making them into permanent residents. I think there's no reason that that type of approach of short-term entry to fill labor market needs and long-term planning can't work in the United States.
Finally, but from both of you, do you hear signs this week that the U.S. actually might tackle comprehensive immigration reform? Melissa, you first.
I was very encouraged. I mean, it's always nice to hear, you know, a shout out to Canada in the presidential speeches. But I'm very encouraged to think that there is a movement afoot for reform. We don't talk in Canada about undocumented workers or, you know, undocumented immigrants in the same way. It's not part of our political parlance, if you will. Not that we don't have issues in terms of enforcement, but it's not a major topic of discussion. And I think that's because our system works well.
Stop bragging, and we'll have to ask Stephen. Stephen, what?
Very un-Canadian.
Yes, right, exactly. Stephen, do you think comprehensive immigration reform is suddenly on the table?
I think it's on the table, but I think it's a very long table, and it's going to be very hard to get to the end of the goal line, to mix my metaphors. Congress has struggled with comprehensive immigration reform for over a decade. I think it's almost impossible to get immigration reform enacted this year, but maybe in the next couple of years we can do it.
Stephen Yale-Lair, professor of immigration law, practiced at Cornell Law School, and Melissa Babel, certified immigration law specialist with the Law Society of Upper Canada. Thank you so much for helping us out here.
My pleasure.
We got a lot of reaction from many of you out there this week when we noted this moment in President Trump's speech before Congress.
Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemy. Ryan's legacy is etched into eternity. Thank you. Thank you.
Many of you suggested this was exploitive, over the top. And in fact, we've made a ritual of sentimentalizing the people who fight our wars in presidential speeches and football games. Seeing the reality of that sacrifice is not ready for prime time, perhaps, but it's there.
I pray late at night when, like, nobody's around, thanking God that I'm still alive and for the life He's given me. It's just the way I see it. Could be going through life bitter as hell, but where would that get me, right?
Sergeant Nick Mendez, who's paralyzed from the neck down from an IED injury in Afghanistan. And his story is part of the reality of veterans facing permanent injury whose lives must go on. And while they are helped by services at the Veterans Administration, it is the work of volunteers who largely make an independent life possible for Nick. It's the amazing story told in the new documentary American Veteran from director Julie Cohen, a story of life near death and love. We meet Wendy, the medical caregiver who became Nick's wife. But the story begins with Nick opening his eyes after his injury and trying and failing to talk.
He couldn't speak because there were stuff in his mouth. He couldn't breathe on his own. He couldn't eat. He was being fed completely intravenously. And over the course of a little more than 6 months in the hospital, he made a fair amount of progress in being able to eat, being able to speak, being able to breathe on his own, having a trach tube taken out, all kinds of things that were pretty monumental progress.
Transitioning to a very high-tech wheelchair?
Transitioning to a mouth-operated, basically sip-and-puff technology, as it's called, has been real lifesaver for Nick in allowing him to do all kinds of stuff. And over the course of the time that we were filming with him, that kind of expanded, and what we show, it expands. He operates his wheelchair by sucking in and blowing out of a straw. He can also play the first-person shooter video games that he loved to play before his injury. Does that with his mouth, with just a little situation he rigged together using a Sony PlayStation console and stylus. And by the end of the film, we actually went with him on a fishing trip where he was using a sip-and-puff fishing pole to go fishing. So there's if you're motivated and smart and ready to go with some of the innovations that are around, there's actually a lot that Nick's able to do.
This is a love story, though. And a lot of people asked him, as you would expect, do you think, why me?
The psychologist came up and asked me, like, a lot of people in your situation ask, why me? Like, why did I get blown up? Why did this happen to me? Does God hate me and all that? I know why this happened to me. I had a really dangerous job.
He turns on that attitude, and suddenly there's a love story.
Yes. So when Nick was in the VA hospital in Long Beach, a woman came in to sort of audition for the job of being his caregiver nurse after he was released from the hospital to go home. Her name was Wendy. Turned out her agency wouldn't cover insurance for vets, so she couldn't be his nurse. But she decided to go back and visit him again. She had really been charmed by him, which was kind of amazing because actually her whole job is doing care for quadriplegics and paraplegics. So you would think, like, you know, sort of busman's holiday. Do you really want to go back and visit a vet? But she really not liked Nick and went and sort of started hanging out with him. And her description of him was just, you know, I've never met anyone who's so much fun to be with. Like, it's impossible not to be smiling and laughing when you're with them, because that's just this guy's personality.
A lot of people, when they're that severely injured, it takes a toll on them, not just physically, but mentally and emotionally. From the first time I met him, he was always in good spirits. If you didn't see the halo on him, you know, the back brace, you wouldn't know that he was injured at all.
That's what attracted her to him. You know, his attitude when he starts to feel something's going on is like, you know, I think she's really hot, but like I just got blown up. I've sort of got some other stuff on my mind. But she kind of hung around and feelings developed and they fell in love. It was actually about a year after he got out of the hospital that the two of them decided to move in together, and that worked out. And ultimately they got married.
Did you buy her feelings of love?
At first, I had the attitude that, frankly, Nick said he had. Like, what kind of girl wants to get with a quadriplegic? Because there's a lot she needs to do with him. If his nose itches, Wendy's got to scratch it for him, you know, literally. They have a situation that makes honesty and direct communication absolutely necessary. How much I saw that she does get from his joy when, you know, when something great happens for him, like how good she feels about it and how much of their life together is like a truly shared entity, you know, certainly made me think a lot about my own marriage and marriage in general.
Now, how amazed were you by the efforts taken by the veterans community itself to heal and take care of its own in this country where supposedly there are all kinds of benefits for people who serve their country?
First of all, there's just sort of this ad hoc day-to-day. There are a number of other vets and disabled vets that live in the same community as Nick does, including his very close friend, John Schumacher, who's a triple amputee Marine, also blown up in Afghanistan. There are organizations of vets doing a lot for each other. There are two that are in our film. One was something called the Foundation for Exceptional Warriors, which is run by vets themselves, almost all volunteers, that just have, on top of their day jobs, work out doing kind of outward bound type adventure trips for vets.
What do you think Americans need to learn generally about the consequences of war from this film?
Dismissing and forgetting is kind of not the right thing to do. It's not that most Americans are unaware that a number of U.S. soldiers have been severely injured, or for that matter, that there are families who are grieving the death of children or spouses, or in cases where the injuries aren't visible, that people are dealing with PTSD or very serious mental health struggles following following war. It's not that people don't know that's true. It's just that we, like, manage to look away from it too much.
Julie Cohen, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
He's been gone, well, be 18 years in March.
You go from headed to medical school to heading to prison. It was almost incomprehensible.
It was hard. He wasn't here for a lot of stuff.
It is a weight lifted off your shoulders. So now he's going to be home and safe.
They granted it and they can't take it back. They can't take it away.
It still seems like a dream. Like I said, he's been turned down so many times.
It is going to be a ride.
President Obama decided to relook at your case and he granted you clemency today.
In the latest in our series, Commuted: Life After Prison, Aaron Glasscock has been set free. The first chapters of his story are available at thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison. Now we get to see the hard realities of rejoining society after 18 years behind bars. In Chapter 4, Takeaway producer Dana Roberson is with Aaron as he arrives at a halfway house.
For nearly two decades, he was inmate 1116717. Today, Aaron Glasscock begins the long process of shedding that identity and discovering who he will become.
Well, you look like you've been here all along.
Yeah.
I know, he looks...
I said he hasn't aged. He looks like...
just looks like when...
he just stepped out of 1995.
Yeah, 1995. Yeah.
We're in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Halfway House, formerly known as a residential reentry center. Yeah. More family members are waiting for Aaron outside.
Okay, I have one question.
Yes. One question.
Do you know how to dab?
No,
it's a new cool thing.
All right, let's do it.
It is a new cool thing. Okay, so you do this.
All right.
The reunion will be short-lived.
Okay. We're going to walk him to the door. He said we can drop him off. We're going to drop him off at the door.
Aaron has to enter the halfway house alone.
Our philosophy is we don't want you to go home, we want you to go home and stay home.
That's Raymond Weiss, president and CEO of Dismas Charities. Founded more than 50 years ago by a Catholic priest, they run dozens of reentry centers throughout the country. He says newfound freedom is disarming.
For the first time, you're immediately in a new facility. You don't know anything about it other than what you've read. So we really try to make our experience welcoming because it is a disruptive experience.
Under the conditions of Aaron's parole, he must live in a halfway house until mid-April. Halfway houses are under the control of the Bureau of Prisons, though most operate privately. When Aaron gets a job, 25% of his salary will go to Dismas Charities. And should he get sick, he'll need to cover his own medical expenses and health insurance.
What we really try to focus on when they come in is slow them down a little bit because, you know, they want to do everything, right? And it would be like a kid in a candy shop.
Jan Kemp is executive vice president and COO.
But the other thing that they tell us when we really get into deep conversation with them is they're scared to death. And so a lot of times they put on a sense of bravado that's really not even them, right? But they're in this new environment. They've got another group of people that they're acclimating to. But behind all that, there's a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And so what we have to do is recognize that and help them appreciate that that's going to happen to them. But we're going to walk them through this step by step.
I had them walk me through what Aaron's first days would be like.
He'll have a fairly extensive orientation process. He'll be assigned a room. There'll be an assessment done. We really want the residents to succeed.
Aaron will have just 21 days to find a job. But Dismas has been doing this a long time, and they say their success rate is high.
Getting individual jobs is not a big challenge because the employer is going to know where they are. They're going to know that they're going to be on time. They're going to know they're drug-free, and they know there's someone that they can call if someone doesn't show up. We make that commitment to the employers, and our employment rates are just phenomenal. We never give up hope on the individual. and we never give up hope that we're going to find ways to make things better. If people are hopeless, then they're desperate. You never want people to lose hope. I mean, there are tremendous numbers of people that really do make it.
Hello?
Hello, Aaron?
Yes, ma'am.
I gave Aaron a call to check in. It's been 3 weeks now since he entered the halfway house.
Well, it was sort of bittersweet because, you know, I got to be with my family for the ride up here, and then I had to go back in. So that's sort of, you know, conflicting emotions, I guess.
Freedom, he is finding, is not instantaneous.
Monday through Friday, I worked every day. So I was used to working all day, and then at night, you know, we had an area to go exercise, play basketball, or I was fortunate that a lot of places had weights so that I could work out that way. And then here, you have like a pool table and not much else. You have like a Swiss ball and some 10-pound dumbbells and a Wii. They do have a Wii. I played it once, I think, just to see how in the world it was. But really, there's not much there either. So wasn't anything to do. Going backwards, it felt like. It went from having freedom in a sense to being really confined.
In order to leave or to get a job, he would need an ID. That meant navigating public transportation for the first time.
I missed the first bus. I was on the wrong side of the road and everything. So I missed the first bus, and then I was sitting there, and I thought that it was coming pretty soon. I tried calling the phone number on the pole, and, well, that time came and went as well that they told me that it was going to be here. So I started to get a little anxious because now I'm feeling like I'm doing something wrong.
The conditions of the house gave Aaron several hours to get there and back.
I had no idea which way north, east, south, or west was from here. Didn't even know the address of where I was going. I knew the name of it, and that was it.
He returned with little time to spare.
I finally made it, but it was definitely a challenging experience. Made me a little anxious, I guess.
His next challenge was to get a job.
They give you 21 days. If you don't have a job in 21 days, they'll send you back to prison, too. Being a convicted felon already, I mean, that's already making it difficult. So that added on to it makes it even more difficult.
As I learned, these were the first among many challenges Aaron would face. After 18 years in prison, Aaron Glasscock is learning just how much he's lost.
You know, I've missed so much. I mean, I missed all of my 30s, majority, all but a year and a couple months of my 20s. So it's like, you know, I'm ready to live, I guess.
On Monday, you'll hear more with Aaron Glasscock, including whether he's found a job and his long list of things he's anxious to do. It will be one of many check-ins we'll have with him as part of our series, Commuted, Life After Prison. For The Takeaway, I'm Dana Roberson.
To make history on gay rights, Richard Socarides had to come out as a gay man to his controversial psychiatrist father, who made a career out of claiming he could cure homosexuality. Richard Socarides' journey to freedom led him to the White House, where he served as an advisor to President Bill Clinton from 1993 to 1999. This story is told in this episode of the epic ABC miniseries When We Rise, based on the Cleve Jones book about 40 years of the LGBTQ rights movement. They cast Richard Socarides' own brother Charles to be the young Richard facing his intolerant dad. The miniseries reenacts the dramatic coming out, and it changed the relationship between these two brothers.
He said that right after we shot it, that it was therapeutic for him, and that's the best possible, just on a personal and professional level.
Once Richard Socarides made it into the White House, getting it right became a matter of history. Did he get it right with Bill Clinton? Richard said those days were about taking things one crisis at a time.
I think people who knew me and people who knew me in my family knew I was interested in government. I think that my role in government would be so focused on LGBT rights was a surprise to pretty much everybody. The fact that I was a gay person was not really a surprise to anybody, but that would be largely my focus and a role that the president gave me, I think, was pretty much a surprise to everybody, including me.
And those were times where, you know, good intentions were often the equivalent of actually taking action, and that no action would get done because people felt like, well, in my heart, I believe that, you know, we're doing the right thing here. And that conflict is part of what this episode is about. I'm going to play a clip from When We Rise, and this is a scene between Cleve Jones and you, but playing you, Richard Socarides. And when we finish, tell me what's going on here.
Socarides, any relation to Charles Socarides, that homophobe shrink who damned my entire generation?
He's my father. Have a good day.
The fact that somebody is homosexual, a true obligatory homosexual, automatically rules out the possibility that he will remain happy for long.
I mean, wow.
Right. I mean, that last part is the audio of a talk my father gave at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where he was a professor at the time. The video of that appears in When We Rise to kind of set the scene of what was happening. But it was video taken from a CBS News special in the early 70s on homosexuality. And, you know, I remember when it appeared in real time. The earlier part of the clip you played is, you know, fast forward, is Charlie speaking to Guy Pearce, who's the actor who plays Cleve Jones, in the 1990s, talking about, you know, the issues that gay and lesbian people, was mostly gay and lesbian people then, faced in the 1990s. And you were exactly right. I mean, you know, it's hard to judge in today's moment Bill Clinton's record on LGBT rights, because so much of it looks like he could have done better, right? But he was a really transformational figure. I mean, he was the first person of that kind of national stature who was willing to say that gay people were entitled to rights and be full participants and full citizens. So it was really transformational, and he set the stage for many of the advances that have come in the last decade.
Although for Cleve Jones in this script to say, Socarides, any relation to Charles Socarides, that homophobe shrink who damned my entire generation, I mean, for you to be in the position you were in the Clinton administration, said to someone like Cleve Jones, oh, well, he isn't serious about LGBT rights.
You know, Cleve's view at the time represented certainly a minority view, but, you know, because we were certainly doing a lot during the Clinton administration for LGBT people, and most of the big LGBT rights organizations were working very closely with us, endorsed President Clinton, you know, both times he ran, and were very enthusiastic supporters of him. But you're right. I mean, the gay movement is never unified. It's always fractured, and people felt like he could do more.
And the story reflects that. That highlights the storyline in a nutshell right there, the Cleve Richard storyline, which is grassroots, band together, progress at any cost, and then Richard, the first establishment figure inside the White House. And there, that scene takes place in the Human Rights Campaign lobby right after that Cleve and Richard have sort of gone at it in a boardroom about getting Clinton to be the first president to appear to keynote an HRC dinner. Huge progress from Richard's point of view. But for Cleve, it was, well, what about this? What about the people dying of AIDS? Why hasn't he done, you know, X, Y, Z?
We'll play the real moment there, but the HRC dinner is significant how?
The HRC dinner is significant how? This was the first time a president showed up saying, you know, to a room full of gay people saying, I see you, you exist. And so for Richard, that was a huge deal. The question in the Cleve-Richard a relationship is, now how far can we get him to go with it? Mm-hmm. Can we get him to apologize? Can we get him to acknowledge all the people that have died from AIDS? Can we get him to acknowledge all that needs to be done, to apologize for Don't Ask, Don't Tell? For
the interesting perspective in the context of the mid-90s is when Bill Clinton went to that dinner, it was huge news. The fact that a sitting president would go to a gay rights event, that was the first time that it ever happened. And symbolically, it sent a powerful message to everybody in the country.
50 years ago, President Truman stood at a new frontier in our defining struggle on civil rights. Slavery had ended a long time before, but segregation remained. Harry Truman stood before the Lincoln Memorial and said, "It is more important today than ever to ensure that all Americans enjoy the rights of freedom and equality. When I say all Americans, I mean all Americans."
So at that moment, did you feel as though this was success? This, I mean, you were making history.
Yeah, we all felt, I think everybody who participated in that event and that evening felt we were making history. Now, whether he was saying enough, we all deeply believed, and I still believe to this day, it was big progress. Now, the most important thing he did, of course, was he signed an executive order, which is still in force today, which banned sexual orientation discrimination throughout the government except the military, because the military was covered by the act of Congress, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So Bill Clinton actually did a lot of substantive good things on the civil rights front for LGBT people. But it's an interesting perspective today to say that one of the most important things he did was just show up at something.
A moment of triumph, but in your heart, could he have gone farther?
Well, that's a difficult question, I think. Listen, there were many of us pushing on the inside, myself included, always to do more. President Clinton would tell you today that that's how things get done. You put smart people who are passionate about something, you give them these White House jobs, and you get them to push you, and you get them to convince you. And I think that that's how we got as much done as we did get done. Could he have done more? Did we try to get him to do more? Of course. But, you know, there are always competing interests. I think, you know, history will be very kind to him in this area particularly.
Richard Socarides and Charles Socarides, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. John.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Takeaway, stumbling around in a dark, smoky room.
So far, we have very little proven facts, and there's a lot of smoke, and the smoke, to people who know what they're talking about, smells right, but where is the fire? And there's a lot of smoke that doesn't smell right.
As Russia complicates the first weeks of the Trump administration, we recall how a century ago it was Russia reeling with revolutionary fervor.
I think that 1917 is the most important period of Russian history, and unfortunately, it's completely forgotten.
Tomorrow, all about Russia, our relationship with that country that continues to define us long after the end of the Cold War. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at ConstantContact.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.